Get ready for Pity City! We're the nasty boys, we got a bad reputation. When you see the nasty coming, better change your direction. Everybody talks, but we know talking teeth. If you mess with the boys, we'll rearrange the teeth. We're the boys, we're the boys, we're the nasty.
Hello, my name is Bob Bammer and welcome to the May 1994 edition of the Wrestling 20 Years Ago podcast. I'm being joined today by a debuting guest, Stuart Brooks. Stuart, how are you?
Yeah, not too bad, Bob. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Stuart is from another podcast doing something very similar to us, but we'll cover that later on. We are going to start with the news. And the big story this month was Charles Austin, a jobber who was paralysed 4 years ago in a match against the Rockers in the WWF, has been awarded $26.7 million by a jury in Florida. There's a lot to that story, and Colin, who's not on the show, has recorded a pre-tape segment that we're going to introduce at the end of the news.
Rick Rude quit WCW this month and possibly wrestling altogether after he suffered multiple injuries and then handed over the WCW International title, walking away from a title match with Vader on WCW Slamboree. Details at this stage are sketchy, but Rude is said to have been suffering from injuries for well over a year, and specific injuries to his neck and back forced him out of some house show dates in Japan. Rude is believed to have an insurance policy with Lloyd's of London that covers disability for some wrestlers, including fellow Minnesotan Kurt Hennig and Nikita Koloff. Rude's place in the main event of Slamboree was taken by Sting.
Ric Flair won the vacant WCW title on WCW Saturday night. Following Spring Stampede, the title was upheld after a draw between Flair and Steamboat. The rematch that went nearly an hour in TV time, in reality it was about 35 minutes, was, but as TV standards go, very, very good. The ending wasn't quite so good as Flair and Steamboat combined in what was meant to be a kind of deliberately frailed leapfrog spot where Flair was meant to kind of collide with Steamboat's groin, I think, but they kind of missed it a bit and it ended up being a slightly soft finish. But that was Flair is now, we believe, an 11-time world champion, but that does seem to change on a week-by-week basis in WCW.
WCW had another strong outing on pay-per-view at Slamboree, with the Nasty Boys and Cactus Jack once again stealing the show with another wild brawl. Cactus Jack won the tag titles with tag partner Kevin Sullivan. Sting, replacing Rick Rude, defeated Vader to win the WCW International title, and Ric Flair retained his WCW World title in a match over Barry Windham. Slamboree was labelled a Legends Reunion and included the introduction of Harley Race, The Crusher, Ernie the Cat Ladd, The Assassin, Ole Anderson and Dick the Bruiser into the WCW Hall of Fame.
Hulk Hogan is almost in WCW. We're not quite there yet. It's been going for a number of months. But Hogan taped another segment for WCW Saturday Night, which aired yesterday, I think, and basically just said, yeah, you know, if the setup was that Hogan said, if people want me, I will be there, and they basically set it up to call the 0900 line, which we'll come to later in the show. The delay really in this Hogan stuff was that Titan had a match offer clause in the contract, but they declined that basically because they've just got so much money to pay Charles Austin and Jesse Ventura. Hogan was expected to make his in-ring debut at Bash at the Beach in July, but early reports from TV taping suggest this may not be the case.
Despite leaving WrestleMania with three viable challenges to his title, WWF champion Bret Hart will face Intercontinental champion Diesel at King of the Ring, although this is a match only for Bret's title. After winning the Intercontinental title at the very end of April, Diesel cut a promo on the first episode in May and said that he wanted a shot at Bret's title. He will be in the title match, but the main event for the show will be Jerry Lawler versus Roddy Piper. Bret's other contenders, Owen is busy with the King of the Ring tournament, which he is surely one of the favourites to win. Lex Luger is tied up with Mr. Perfect, and Yokozuna is busy losing sumo matches on Raw to Earthquake.
Eastern Championship Wrestling held a mixed tag team match between Mixed Peaches and Tommy Caro versus the Sandman and Woman, where the person who was pinned would be caned using a kendo stick, which ECW branded as a Singapore cane due to some stories coming out from over there. The build focused on the character development of the Sandman, who's now a heel who smokes on camera. Caro was said to have moved in with Mixed Peaches in storyline. The heels won the match, which, barring a quick TV recap, did not air on television.
Also in May, we've seen title changes across all three promotions this month. We've already documented the victories for Ric Flair, Sting, and the team of Cactus Jack and Kevin Sullivan in WCW. In the WWF, the Head Shrinkers, with Captain Lou Albano in their corner, won the WWF Tag Team titles, defeating the Quebecers. And in ECW, the television title changed hands once again. This time, the Pitbull lost to relative unknown Mikey Whipwreck when Pitbull was knocked out by the Tasmaniac.
Okay, that will end the normal news part of the show. We're now going to cut to a pre-tape segment from Colin Judkins, who's going to cover that Charles Austin story in full.
Charles Austin, a jobber who was left paralysed after an incident in a WWF match in 1990, has been awarded $26.7 million by a jury in Florida at the very end of April. Austin was teaming with Lanny Poffo to face the Rockers, Marty Jannetty and Shawn Michaels. He was to receive the Rocker Dropper, where he would fall downwards with his body horizontal, with the view of almost landing on his face. Instead, Austin claimed he was instructed by Jannetty to take the move like a forward roll. He ended up landing on his head and breaking his neck. Doctors initially feared that the incident would mean he was paralysed from the neck down for life, but in the 3 years that followed, he has regained some feeling in his arms and legs, and is able to move around with the help of crutches. Perhaps what makes this story more perplexing is that Austin's lawsuit originally asked for $3.8 million in damages, although in closing, Austin's lawyer did ask for $7 million. It's very rare for a jury to award the total amount asked. Austin would go on to be awarded six times the amount. Austin received $19 million, his wife $5.2 million, and their sons a total of $600,000. It is expected that the WWF will have insurance to cover the damages. Numerous people in the world of wrestling testified for the WWF, including Jannetty, Michaels, Killer Kowalski, Lanny Poffo, and J.J. Dillon. Perhaps most noteworthy was the man who was the plaintiff's key witness, two-time WWF champion Bruno Sammartino. Sammartino told the Pro Wrestling Torch, quote, "I thought it was a great injustice. In my opinion, Jannetty did nothing to protect a guy who was so green. The poor guy was told not to worry. A very experienced guy wouldn't have relied on Jannetty alone. He would have protected himself," end quote. More damning of the company, perhaps, was the observation from some in the courtroom that all of the witnesses for the defence lacked credibility, with some of their stories not just conflicting, but conflicting with their own sworn depositions.
Stuart, let's move on to WCW Slamboree. I will start, as always, by reading out the results. We started actually with the Legends introduction. I won't read through all of those now. We'll come to those when we get to it. The first match of the show was Steve Austin defeating Johnny B. Badd to retain the WCW United States Championship. Terry Funk and Tully Blanchard fought to a double disqualification. Larry Zbysko defeated WCW World Television Champion Lord Steven Regal in a non-title match. Dustin Rhodes defeated Bunkhouse Buck in a bull rope match. Ric Flair defeated his mystery opponent, Barry Windham, to retain the WCW World Heavyweight Championship. We have the WCW Hall of Fame inductions, the Assassin, Ole Anderson, Harley Race, Ernie the Cat Lad, the Crusher, and Dick the Bruiser. Cactus Jack and Kelly Sullivan defeated the Nasty Boys to win the WCW World Tag Team Championships with special guest referee Dave Schultz of the Philadelphia Flyers hockey team. And in the main event, Sting defeated Vader to win the vacant WCW International World Heavyweight Championship. Before we start, I probably best preface this show with a couple of things that are happening with the build-up. We mentioned the Rude stuff. I'll cover that in a little more detail now. Basically, Rude faced Sting in a match in Japan at the beginning of May and won the international title by a screwing means. That was very much part of the plan. And then since then, details, as we said in the news, are quite sketchy, but Rude either got injured or re-injured something or just decided he didn't want to do it anymore. But there's a fair amount of suspicion, you know, with the legitimacy of what's going on. But essentially, it seems like he's quit WCW. He was in Philadelphia, but he is as good as done. And so there was that, and I'll come to that bit on the show when we get to it. Also, there was mystery over whether Barry Windham was going to be fit for his match with Ric Flair. So much so that on WCW TV, they just couldn't build it. I think the week before the show, they had a man in a mask run out and attack Ric Flair. And obviously with the idea that if he doesn't make it, we'll put someone else in there. Now, quite disappointingly, there were rumours that if it wasn't Windham, it would have been Terry Funk and Ric Flair. And as we saw about 5 years ago, those guys are very good when you put them in the ring together. But Barry Windham did make it for his match. That will start with that. Anyway, that's a bit of backstory, and we'll intertwine that when we get to it. Stuart, your overall thoughts on this show before we break it down?
It was okay. Not great, but not terrible. I think the in-ring content was a lot better than the booking around it. I mean, you looked at the issue there with Barry Windham and the Mystery Man stuff. That didn't really make me want to buy this show. I don't see how that would make anyone want to buy this show. And yeah, the possibility of Ric Flair and Terry Funk, given Funk's performance on this show, would have been a lot more interesting.
Yeah, I mean, an odd one from a buyer's perspective, in the sense that they were advertising Vader and Rude days leading up to the event, I think because they probably hadn't had time to work out who the opponent was going to be. And so you effectively had your international title and your world title, one with a match that you thought you knew but ended up being different, and one with a match you didn't know. And so that was a bit weird. I thought the show was probably a bit stronger than you did. The in-ring content I actually thought was decent. Once again with WCW, I think that the match, the kind of final four matches were all good or better. And the tag team match was just astonishing again. But just too many ref bumps in this show. I've got five or six marked down in my notes. A lot. And again, it was kind of one of those things where we've had problems with WCW in the past. We've just had a ton of screwy finishes. This wasn't always the case with this. It was just more, let's have a ref bump and then, but yeah, in fact there were a couple of odd finishes, but no, I thought it was a good show on the whole. In-ring work was good. Opening hour was what it was. But it picked up down the stretch. We will start with the introductions of the legends at the start of the show. I'll read them out for the sake of it. Ollie Anderson, Perry Banner, Red Bastion, Tully Blanchard, The Crusher, Don Curtis, Terry Funk, in theory, we'll come to that in a sec, Vern Gagne, Hardballs, Haggerty, Larry Hennig, Killer Kowalski, Ernie Ladd, Wahoo McDaniel, Angela Mosca, Harley Race, who was booed, Ray Stevens, Lou Thayers, Mr. Wrestling 2, and Tommy Young. It was all right. I mean, they set up Terry Funk not coming out later on in the show, and I'll come to that bit when we get to it. But it made for a very awkward segment where they seemed to fail to tell Vern Gagne that he wasn't meant to be out there. And so it made me and Gene Oakland look a bit stupid when it's clearly not Terry Funk, and yet he announced him like long after he'd walked out.
Well, the graphic couldn't keep up with it either, so when Vern Gagne does wander out, it does have Terry Funk's name on there. The segment itself, it's one of those things. I mean, even when the WWF does this kind of thing, it's one of those who works backstage, who's politically in favour. So people that might not necessarily be deemed a legend at one time because they work in the company. I mean, you've got the assassin there, Jody Hamilton, who people might not really consider on that sort of top tier, but he's being bought out as a legend in this context. The other thing I picked up on from this was Tully Blanchard getting quite a lot of cheers.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, he's been knocking about. I know he's more recent. I mean, I guess what you've got to remember with all these legends is that they're stretching like such a massive kind of spread of time. You know, I mean, Luthers has been retired for God knows how long, same with Vern Gagne, and other of these guys are more recently on TV. Also, we've got Harley Race, who got a quite a nice heel reaction while he's knocking about at the moment. So I think it's maybe that, and maybe just kind of guys who've worked in, you know, Philadelphia, which is where this show's at. Maybe there's something to do with that as well.
Yeah.
Opening match, Steve Austin defeated Johnny Badd. It was okay. Let me just consult my notes. We got a "we're not hostile" chant during this opening match,
yes,
which was in reference to, I believe it was a study released at the beginning of the month, which said that Philadelphia is the most hostile city to live in America.
Yes.
Yeah. So there was that. I mean, there were some quite interesting chants throughout the show. As an opener, it was fine, although it never really got going, and then a very kind of confusing finish with kind of Johnny Badd picked up Austin for kind of like a back body drop, bounced him off the rope, and I think with the idea that Austin was meant to flip over into kind of a cross body block and fall on top of him. Austin didn't manage that, so they kind of just fell backwards, and then Austin rolled over him and pinned him. And this wasn't the only confusing finish of the night, or even the month.
Yeah, the finish was definitely mistimed, and the pin looked very, very weak. I thought it was a decent enough opener. There was some nice technical stuff to start, and a couple of decent spots in there as well, with the tombstone into the head scissors spot. I quite liked that. The Philly crowd as well, when they went to the more technical stuff, there was a boring chant going on, which I guess you have to expect in Philly. How many We Want Blood chants did we get all night? So they're not exactly going to respond well to sort of technical work. But yeah, decent stuff, I thought.
We had a backstage segment with Ernie Ladd and Wahoo McDaniel. What do you think of these backstage? Oh, well, I say backstage, they were kind of on the stage. It was Mean Gene Okerlund interviewing some of the legends. I thought, barring one, which I'll come to later on, and there's a bizarre Dusty Rhodes segment coming next as well. They were okay. The one with Luthers and Vern Gagne that followed the tag match was really good, and I'll come to that when we get to it. Otherwise, these were, I guess they were nice filler breaks. I didn't really say a lot. And it kind of felt like there was, you had a couple of the legends that were very much in tune with what was going on, and a lot weren't.
Oh yeah, absolutely. The Vern Gagne, Luthers one that you mentioned later on. Yeah, Gagne wasn't really in tune with what's going on in WCW at the time, whereas Thez at least tried to put over that, oh, well, things are different since our time. Yeah, I mean, they sort of existed half to plug Gene Oakland's 900 numbers, didn't they?
Yeah, that's true. And not the worst use of the 900 number, and we'll come to that later when we get to it. Yeah. And then we got to, God, this Dusty Rhodes. So, like, Dusty Rhodes wasn't there, which I thought was a bit weird. They then said he was in Hollywood, so they cut to a shot of Dusty Rhodes very clearly in front of a blue screen, in front of a still photo of the Hollywood sign in the back in the hills. And then, yeah, Dusty Rhodes basically said, I'm not retired, I'm still in my prime, which is worrying. Yes. And then that was really it. It was just a very odd segment, and you're kind of thinking, shouldn't Dusty Rhodes be there? I know there's all the stuff going on backstage, whether he's in power or not, but you figured if he's in enough to get on the show, he'd be invited and he'd make sure he was there.
And certainly with the situation with his son later on in the night as well. But yeah, God help us if he genuinely thinks he's still in his prime.
Yes, yes, that is true. Second match of the night, Terry Funk versus Tully Blanchard. This was a bit disappointing. There was a brawl on the outside. There was, what did we get? We got Funk did a pile driver onto a wooden board, a DDT on the stage. There was a We Want Blood chant as well. There was a ref bump, Funk got a chair, there was another ref bump, Funk got a branding iron, and then the ref called for a double DQ, and then Funk just, the crowd shouted bullshit, Funk kind of just went mad going around the ring, but that could very easily be him in storyline or not, knowing Terry yeah. Funk. I was disappointed by this. It was, I guess it could have been the start of a good match, but cut off too soon. Too many ref bumps. Given the too many involved, this could have been a lot more.
I think I actually like this a little bit more than you, in that it was presented as a Legends match, so this isn't your current set of stars. And when you see these kind of Legends matches, it often leaves you with a bad taste in your mouth of people who are way past their prime. Whereas Funk, who must be in his 50s by now, can still go with the best of them. And again, Tully looked very good considering he hasn't been an active in-ring competitor on a major scale since 89.
Yeah, for what it's worth, I think Funk's 47. They're not quite as old as you think. But yeah, I think it's probably more the finish in the sense that, you know, I mean, there was reports, I think Dave Meltzer said that he thought that they wanted to beat Blanchard, but Blanchard said no, given that Funk in theory is coming back next month. Might explain the screwy finish, but from a kind of viewing standpoint, like, who are you protecting? Like, this is a Legends match between two guys that don't appear on your show very often. Why are you protecting them? I think more the finish than the match itself, but it felt like 5 minutes too short and the finish was awful. That was kind of where I was.
Yeah, I'll definitely agree on the finish. Yeah, yeah, it wasn't good. Also, the pile driver onto the board that clearly didn't hit the board in any way whatsoever looked a bit weak.
Yeah, and there was the spot where Funk set up for a pile driver onto the steel chair, which was folded out, as in like, so you could sit on it. They were on the turnbuckle. And I don't know. I don't know whether that was a planned spot or not, because it's not like Blanchard very clearly reversed it. Funk just kind of fell off the top rope and then they just didn't do the spot. So, and
I'm glad. It sort of fizzled.
Yeah, I'm glad they didn't do the spot, because that's very difficult to control, but it didn't look as if they'd set it up with the view that Blanchard would get out of it. But yeah, we go backstage. Ric Flair was interviewed by Jesse Ventura. Not much was said there. Larry Zbysko versus Lord Steven Regal in what was, I believe, a non-title match, or certainly given that Zbysko won, but didn't win the match. What do you think about this?
Why are WCW doing non-title matches on pay-per-view? Surely that's what you use the Clash of the Champions, you use Saturday Night for, you build. People want to see the title matches, or you want people to pay to see the title matches.
Well, as we saw, well, we're going to come to it, the Ricky Steamboat, Ric Flair TV title match, and with, spoiler alert, and with these two, they're having a title match on WCW Saturday Night, I think in 2 weeks' time. So...
Does that not seem backwards to you, logic-wise?
Yeah, particularly with the world title thing. I guess the idea in theory is that they can use it to try and get people to watch their TV program, which in theory makes sense, but it's not like the Flair and Steamboat thing did any great TV ratings either. Because Zbysko is going to win the title in a couple of weeks, on TV. So yeah, I don't know. I don't know why you wouldn't do it tonight. Maybe it was just because they were changing the tag titles. They were changing, the international title.
Okay.
Maybe they didn't want a third title change to get lost in the shuffle. Maybe that was it.
Fair enough. I thought the match was okay. Again, Larry Zbysko very much in tune with how to play a babyface in Philadelphia.
Yes.
I thought, using the ropes for leverage behind the referee's back and just sort of playing games with the crowd with that. They got into him through that. Regal is very much in tune with his character as well. A bit too much stalling for my liking from him.
Oh, at the start. I mean, it was about 2.5 minutes where anything happened.
Yeah.
And
again, and they went to the mat as well. Boring chance. But again, Zbysko was able to come out of that and get it back in tune with what that crowd in front of him wanted.
Yeah, and the match finished. Regal went for a double underhook suplex. Zbysko reversed it into a backdrop and got a pin. Again, non-title match, but there will be a title change, I believe, on WCW Saturday Night in the next couple of weeks, I think. Then we got Terry Funk can cut a great promo. I mean, I'm watching all the ECW stuff at the moment. He can cut a great promo on there. This wasn't quite the same in the sense that he didn't have like the material or like the talking points to really get at. But basically, me and Gene Oakland said, Terry Funk, why weren't you out on the stage? And Funk said, and I quote, I am not a legend, I am the legend. And then Funk just, it was, I guess you could call it rambling, but it wasn't rambling in a way that was bad. He just kind of went off on one. It kind of portrayed him just to be a little bit insane. But I get the sense that's Terry Funk.
Oh, absolutely. I thought he was the star of this show between his match, this interview, and his appearance later in the night that we'll cover. I thought, certainly in front of that crowd as well, he came across as the star of the show.
Yeah, well, makes sense given that he's operating in for ECW in Philadelphia and they're in Philadelphia. They were into him. There was ECW chants during his match. He was just a very over star and not all of them were. If Funk was brought in on the basis he thought he was going to beat Tully Blanchard and then they said, look, Tully's not going to lie down for you. Maybe he just thought, screw it, I'm going to get me money, I'm just going to go out there and just have some fun.
And do my own thing, absolutely.
Then we got the Hall of Fame inductions. Gordon Soley introduced the inductions of Harley Race, who again was heavily booed. The Crusher, Ernie the Cat Lad, the Assassin, Ollie Anderson, and the now deceased Dick the Bruiser. What did you think of this? I mean, it was... Yeah, they perhaps didn't have enough videos, a lot of kind of like newspaper clippings and photos. And there's a nice story with Dick the Bruiser on the end. I think his daughter came out to accept the induction on his behalf. Also, the Assassin couldn't get a plaque because they made two Harley Race plaques and not one for the Assassin, so they couldn't show it for what that was worth. It was fine. It didn't last too long. They got through it. The crowd weren't terribly into it. They were respectful. But again, I think it's one of those things where, as Dave Meltzer kind of said in his report, which was kind of like, this would probably be more effective if it was a company that paid attention to its history in the other 11 months of the year.
Yeah. The one confusing element for this, of this for me, was the induction of Harley Race, who's currently managing your top heel. So I think there was a sort of confused reaction from the audience of, okay, are we supposed to kind of show this man respect for what he's done, but at the same time, on television and on this show, he'll be portrayed as a villainous manager.
Yeah, no, and that probably summed up the reaction, where it was, there were boos, and there were some respect, but yeah, I think it was a reaction that was probably quelled by the timing, and maybe the sort of thing, wait another year, see where he's at, and by that point, maybe it's better to induct him.
He was excellent in his role.
Yes, no, very much so. Very, you know, to the point. He has that kind of voice where, yeah, they've had him on commentary a couple of times, and he's got a very different sound to Tony Schiavone. But I think for something like this, he has the right kind of voice for it. He sounds like he's from 20 years ago anyway.
Oh, absolutely. And yeah, he fits in with the people around him. So yeah, good effort.
And also, I think more to the point that he probably knows a lot and has seen a lot of those guys. So it's easier for him to kind of do this kind of thing, because it's not him learning a script or learning other people's achievements. He probably knows a lot of it.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Backstage segment with Jesse Ventura interviewing Colonel Robert Parker, who refused to reveal Flair's opponent. Then we got Dustin Rhodes versus Bunkhouse Buck in a bull rope match. Your thoughts on this?
Yeah, pretty good. Very violent. Different to what the opening of the card had been, so the Philly crowd were way more into it. Obviously, it would go further down that sort of violence route with the tag match later on. But yeah, this got the crowd absolutely into it. One thing I want to say is that Booksnort, Tennessee is the greatest town anyone's ever hailed from.
Yes.
We want blood chants again, and the crowd would receive that later on in the match. Dusty Spots got a big pop from the crowd, which is something I can imagine he'll use to leverage himself back into a higher backstage position. Seeing his son do that routine and get a good response from the crowd will lead him to point to himself as someone who should be coming back on television. I liked this match. The stuff with the bull rope was well worked. I liked the spot where Dustin was tied around the ring post. Good stuff.
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed this match. I think they're two for two in terms of good matches. A really good match at Spring Stampede as well. I guess when you've got two guys like this where you're just putting them in stipulation matches, but I think they're delivering, yeah, the bull rope matches, they're not always great. And you need two guys that kind of know what they're doing. But I think with these two guys, they're both pros. I agree, the spot where he was wrapped around the ring post was really good. Finish was another ref bump. Colonel Robert Parker interfered. He kind of tied up Rhodes to his skate. He then nailed Bunkhouse Buck with the belt and won. And after the match, we got another fix of Terry Funk, who ran out and attacked Dustin Rhodes. What do you think about Funk? Seems like we're setting up Funk and Buck versus Dustin and Dusty, I think it's next month. So that might be interesting, because they've got a show in Orlando, and that kind of makes sense with that regard. What do you think of Funk's involvement here?
Yeah, absolutely. I think he fits very well in, if that's where they're going, putting him in Robert Parker's stable. Buck, I think, is very, very convincing as the sort of, he's not a wrestler, he's a fighter, and Funk certainly fits into that mold, although he's very capable of wrestling. Fits very well as a crazy brawler. As far as Dusty being Dustin's partner, I'd rather it was somebody else, but I see the likelihood of that is where it's going.
And if he is, well, unlike he says, if he is past his prime, that is the match to put him in, which is in a tag match. Dustin does most of the work. He can do the Bionic Elbow and a bit more.
Yes, tag, yeah.
We got another station with Raider Crippler Stevens and Red Bastion with Mean Gene Oakland. We then had Ric Flair versus his mystery opponent, which was Barry Windham. Your thoughts on this and the match?
Really, really very disappointed in this. I thought Windham showed up not looking in very good shape at all. But from what I remember, when he last left WCW, he wasn't in great shape either. Again, given the match on WCW television, I kind of wonder why they didn't stick Flair and Steamboat on again. You had the confusing finish at Spring Stampede. And then they obviously blew that off on television. And then to bring back Wyndham for this sort of anticlimactic match. And I can't see him, based on this performance, hanging around in that sort of top end of WCW. Overall, it was quite disappointing.
Yeah, I mean, the crowd was really hot for Flair, but it just... Yeah, you know, it's the age-old thing. You always believe Ric Flair can get a really good match out of anybody, and, you know, this isn't to say it disproves the point, but this, as Ric Flair matches go, this is really poor. As normal matches go, it wasn't bad, but you have a bar set pretty high for Flair matches, and it just didn't go anywhere. What happened with the finish? Oh, that's right, yeah, we had Colonel Ort Park, who was out kind of managing Barry Windham. It was a great moment where, Wyndham was using leverage. He was holding on to Parker, who was still up on the apron, to use leverage to pin Flair. The ref counts a second, looks over, sees Colonel Ort Parker, and rather than admonishing Parker, he just kicks him in both arms.
Yes.
That was great. Like, we've never seen more enough of that. So we got that. We had Sensuous Sherry at ringside. She was there. It's kind of sat. Kind of first few rows in the crowd. She's still looking for someone to manage. I don't think we got resolution to that tonight. I gotta say that we're gonna come to his match with Steamboat. Two for two with really soft Ric Flair finishes, where he kind of came off the top rope for a cross body block, but he kind of landed on his feet before he even connected.
Yeah.
And then he kind of had to just like fall over on top of Wyndham and got the pin. An unsatisfying end to an unsatisfying match, I'd say. Not as bad as maybe we're playing it up. I think he watched this in isolation, but knowing Ric Flair and again thinking what could have been with him and Terry Funk, he could have gone that way, although... Yeah, I mean, I guess if you want to keep Flair, that might, would have worked with Funk, but I guess they hadn't set up that for the main event. But yeah, just flat.
I thought the other thing it took them way too long to bring up on commentary was the horseman background between the two.
Yeah, no. Yeah, okay. And this is the kind of thing we speak about earlier with the Hall of Fame stuff. If you pay more attention and you ram home more of the historical stuff, when you come to actually trying to do a show called Legends Reunion, it helps.
Yeah.
Moving on. We go to the tag team match, which was the Nasty Boys versus, Kevin Sullivan and Cactus Jack. Cactus Jack was replacing Evad Sullivan, who was another injury. It's Dave Sullivan, reversed his name, who was injured. We'll see an appearance from him. And we had Dave Schultz from the Philadelphia Flyers as the special guest referee. This was called a Chicago Street Fight, I think. Just another walking brawl. If you saw the match last month, this was kind of the same. Last month was brilliant. This month was also brilliant. God knows what we got here. Cactus Jack jumped off the top rope to the outside, through a trash can, which Knobs was lying on, but he moved. There was a brawl on the ramp. Jack went through a table, and I'll come to the finish in a second. What do you think of this match?
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. The spot you mentioned with Jack going through the trash can from the top or second rope, incredible. Looked absolutely devastating. I hope he's all right from it. And I do wonder what kind of toll these bumps are taking on him. But as a spot to watch, it was absolutely incredible. The pile driver on the ramp by Sullivan as well looked brilliant. Jack went through a table off the ramp as well. Just crazy, crazy, crazy brawl. Yeah, really, really enjoyed it.
And then we get to the finish. We've got Sags on top rope, does a top rope elbow drop to Jack on the inside. Then Dave Schultz kind of leans in to go and make the cover, and Sags kind of gets up and almost like pushes him out of the way, which doesn't impress Dave Schultz at all. Sags goes over to the corner and picks up Schultz's hockey stick, because, you know, it's a street fight, so Schultz has come armed. Yes. Well, I actually thought that made sense in this kind of scenario, given that what was involved and given that, you know, he's an outsider and he's a hockey player. You bring a hockey stick. That kind of made sense. They got into an argument. There was some pushing, some shoving. Jack picked up the then dropped hockey stick, nailed Sags over the head, went to pin him. Schultz did the world's quickest three count. And we have new tag team champions. And then after the match, we had Max Payne coming out. He came out with the guitar, which, if you recall back to Super Bowl back in February, that he got smashed over the head with. Max Payne came out with guitar, and Sags, who got up by this point, got blindsided by a brutal guitar shot. And then we even got Ivan Sullivan coming out as well, who came out on his crutches and cracked knobs over the head with a crutch. Apparently nobody got injured in this mess, but what I will say is that, yeah, Nasty Boys have been going for a long while, kind of last 7 or 8 months as tag champs, having all these kind of screwy finishes, and in the last few months having really good matches, and I'll come to that bit in a minute, but this was great. This was the culmination of all that stuff. You know, the heels finally got their comeuppance. Max Payne comes out and retaliates, returns the favor with a chair shot from Super Brawl. Ivan Sullivan comes out as well. I thought this was fantastic.
Yeah, it was a really nice moment after the match to see the Nasty Boys finally get their comeuppance, yeah, and the sort of collective group. Obviously, Sullivan and Jack have been forced to team together, injuries to their partners, so it was a nice moment for all four of them to be out there. I read that Sags was legitimately knocked out by that guitar shot, and it did look devastating.
Yeah, it did. I think no serious injuries. Sorry, I'm just rereading the report. So yeah, for what that's worth. But no, I mean, the Nasty Boys. I mean, you know, they're not great wrestlers. Yeah, you know that. You just got to look at them. But they have the first 5 months of this year, they have been excellent. And, you know, Cactus Jack deserves his role in that, as does Max Payne, as even does Kelly and Sullivan. But they've been given the kind of the free rein to go and do what they want to do. Really good.
I know a lot of the booking surrounding sort of the big matches on this show has been very messy, but I thought this was one of a good example of where they got absolutely everything right. Like you say, the Nasty Boys, they're not great wrestlers, but if you put them in these situations where they can do what they do very well, it works.
Yeah, no, completely agree. We cut to the stage where Mean Gene Okerlund is with Vern Gagne and Lou Thesz. This was kind of like the rest of them in terms of you've got variation of guys, how in tune they are with the product. The one bit I really liked in all this, and you might think, what do you like about this? But I'll explain why in a second, was that Mean Gene Okerlund asked Vern Gagne specifically about that match. And he said, on a quote, that had nothing to do with wrestling, as in to try and hate on it. And you might think, well, that's effectively a babyface, you know, hating on the match. But what I really liked about that was that we're in Philadelphia, a crowd that's chanting, we're not hostile, we want blood, ECW rebellious. You get the old guy, you know, the guy that the young kind of 20, 25-year-old male thinks, you know, he's over the hill. He says, that's not wrestling. If I'm the person, or I'm not sure they were beaming this audio into the arena, but if I'm that kind of 25-year-old person, and I hear Vern Gagne saying, this isn't wrestling, I automatically become more enamoured with that, because it's like, well, you're an old guy. You don't get it anymore. I'm not saying he doesn't, but that was why I liked that. It was, maybe I'm overanalyzing one line, but for that reason alone, I really liked this bit.
I thought Jack and Sullivan were the most over baby faces of the entire night. So yeah, having Vern Gagne say, that's nothing to do with my sport, it's legitimately his feelings on it, I imagine. But yeah, it didn't portray him in the best light with the crowd. And yeah, they were certainly on the side of Cactus Jack and Kevin Sullivan.
Yeah, no, completely. We will cut to the main event, which is Vader versus Sting. I'll fill in the bit that I actually didn't cover when it actually came up in the show. Just after the Legend introduction, we had Nick Bockwinkel coming out. He invited out Sting, who was wearing just an amazing bright red suit. Fantastic.
Oh.
Worth watching the pay-per-view alone just to see the colour of this suit. Basically, Nick Bockwinkel said, and there's just tons of, like, really in all this, Bockwinkel said, having reviewed the tapes of the Rude Sting match in Japan where the title changed hands, they decided that because the title change was a little bit nefarious, they were going to reverse the decision. Now, I'm thinking, hello, what about all the other screwy title changes right in the last year that you haven't reviewed and overturned? But anyway, you know, it's wrestling, you take what you can with it. And basically he said, look, you're back as champion. And Sting basically, in not so many words, went, I'm a baby face, I'm not champion, I'm gonna win it. And Sting then said, right, I'm gonna face Vader in the main event. So that gets us to Sting versus Vader, as I turn four pages in my notes. We had a psych out at the start of the match. Sting hit a wonderful vertical suplex on Vader, and he held that for a long time. We had a couple of Vader bombs, we had a ref bump, a really kind of out of control choke slam, kind of Sting landed, I think, on a combination between his head and his shoulder. We had Reyes hitting Vader with a chair, or tried to set up that spot again. We had a Vader assault, Sting moved, then so Vader's laid out on the floor. Harley Race tries to do his diving headbutt into the ring and lands on Vader again. That happened last month as well. Sting hit the splash from the top rope. Pin, referee came round, won the title. Maybe not quite as good as some of their other matches in the past, but still really good. I think given the lack of build, the fact it wasn't a world title match, it was an international title match, I thought this was a really good main event.
I thought it was decent. Like you say, not as good as their stuff in 92, so it almost felt like a bit of a sort of greatest hits match. They, like you say, it's been thrown together with very little build, so they went to the spots they know they could do. And would fit in the match. Did you pick up on the Sting must die chants from the non-hostile Philly crowd early on?
No, I didn't. Yes. But well heard.
Yes.
But yes, one of those things really. But no, it's Sting in most places at least is very over. So, you know, you take what you can with that. But I think it's one of those things that these two have faced off a number of times before. They're both pros. They can both put on a really good match together. And as much as we didn't get Vader and Race, I think the show was all the more better for it. Because I think if this had been Vader and Race, this match would have been a much inferior main event. And it might have dragged down the overall perception of the show.
Yeah, I mean, Vader and Rude would have had very little build towards it either. And again, you've got two kind of heels going at it. Given the Philly crowd, though, that they might have preferred that, actually. The finish, Race interfering twice and backfiring. Okay, if you want to do it once, that's fine. Doing it twice starts to get on my nerves a little.
Yeah, it's just one of those things where, like, if you take each match in turn, the ref bumps kind of make sense. But once you get into kind of like number four, number five, a bit too many in one show. Stuart, yeah. Your overall thoughts on the show and a score rating out of 10?
Out of 10, I think I have to sit it right in the middle for a 5 out of 10. Like I said, there's some good in-ring action on the show and some matches certainly worth watching. Like I say, the Kevin Sullivan and Cactus Jack defeated the Nasty Boys. Go out of your way to see that. But I just feel, given all the stuff that's going on around WCW with regards to Rude leaving, Wyndham coming back in, Hogan potentially coming in, there's a lot of muddy waters that I feel like maybe this show could have started to move towards clearing up. For one, I can't see Hogan walking into the company in a situation where there's two world titles. Given that he may come in very, very soon, they could have potentially used this show to clear that up.
Yeah, I was a bit positive. I gave it a 7 out of 10. The first hour was what it was. I think I let them off a little bit on all the stuff with kind of the finishes and the stipulations, given just how much this card changed or could have changed in the 2 weeks leading up to the show. Given that the main event changed, the Ric Flair Barry Windham match, I think they found out 3 or 4 days before the match that Windham was past fit to do the match. They had to change the Cactus Jack thing over. All of that being said, yeah, there was, I think one or two many rep bumps, but the match quality, particularly as we got nearer the main event, was good to very good. And the tag match was fantastic again. And yeah, I thought it was another good WCW pay-per-view. And I didn't, unlike other shows, I think it was one of those things that it might have been as overbooked as previous shows, but it was better. And so I could kind of look past that. And we will move on to the WCW TV review. We'll kind of work back through it. Hulk Hogan, as I said in the news, was interviewed on the set of Thunder in Paradise. Basically, me, Gene Oakland said, "Do you want to come back?" And they set up this 900 number. Call in if you want to quote unquote make the difference for Hulk Hogan returning to WCW or joined WCW. Hogan said, "If you want me to go along for the ride one more time, just let me know. I'm the man to drive." That was the quote. Stuart, as uses of 900 numbers go to get people to pay money to try and convince them to sign Hogan when he's just about signed, it's not the most the poorest use of the 900 line. I still give that to the WWF back at the Royal Rumble for saying, "Phone in to decide who you thought won the Royal Rumble match," and then just ignoring it. But it does continue the routine of, I would call, misuse of the 900 number.
It's getting to the point now where it's starting to irritate me. It's getting to the stage in both major companies where it's ring up to listen to what wrestler X had for lunch. Like you say, the Hogan decision is made. The Royal Rumble decision was made. Getting people to call these numbers solely to try and impact these decisions. I know wrestling is a dishonest business, but I see this as even beyond that.
Yeah, I mean, it's like one of those things where we had this discussion, I don't know, 5 or 6 months ago on the show. It's kind of, if you advertise it and you deliver what you advertise, I don't really mind it. If it is just what did Hulk Hogan eat for lunch today, and that's what you're selling, and that's what you deliver, and you're saying it's going to cost, I don't know, $1 a minute, $1.50 a minute, fine. But when it's kind of going beyond dishonest when you're saying, ring up to make the difference when he's pretty much already signed.
Yeah, I mean, I thought the perfect use of it on the show was towards the end where Gene Okerlund is saying, ring the number to listen to what Colonel Robert Parker and the Stud Stable have got to say. Like you say, you're delivering exactly what you're advertising there. You are getting to listen to some wrestlers cut promos down the phone line. And if that's what you're advertising and that's what you're delivering, that's absolutely fine. If people want to pay $1.50 a minute to listen to that, no problem. But it's like I say, the dishonesty of help us make this decision that I don't necessarily agree with.
I won't go into my own opinions on Hogan because I've done it, I think, in the last 3 shows. But Stuart, your thoughts on Hulk Hogan joining WCW?
My fear is he will turn WCW into what he wants it to be rather than necessarily what it needs to be. Do I think he'll bring a lot of new eyes to the product? Absolutely. Do I think he'll bring a lot of mainstream media attention? Absolutely. Will we see the subsequent hiring of the Jim Duggans and the Brutus Beefcakes? Almost certainly. But it's then where do you fit in the WCW main players around him? Flair is slow burning towards a heel turn, I feel. He's very popular with the crowd at the moment, so I don't necessarily know if that's the right thing to do. And again, where do Hogan and Sting fit in together? I can't see Hogan wanting to be 1A to Sting's 1.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with the Flair thing, like, I thought he was as good as a heel last month, but he very much wrestles as a babyface on this pay-per-view. And yeah, I'd say very much as a babyface. I guess, as you said, it's kind of Philadelphia crowd. You're almost a pseudo face in a way. But yeah, I won't elaborate much more on that. And I think it's just kind of let's wait for him to join now and see what happens really. And the other kind of big thing, as we kind of referenced in the news and during that pay-per-view review, was the Ric Flair, Ricky Steamboat title match. On those WCW Satellite, as I say, it took up about an hour of TV time, probably about a 30 odd minute worth of match. It was, I would say, as TV matches go, excellent. Almost too good for pre-taped television, as we kind of alluded to earlier. Isn't this the kind of match, like, particularly as there was no obvious main event for this show, wouldn't it have made perfect sense, Steamboat and Flair on Slamboree?
Absolutely, 110% agree with you. As a TV match, like you say, absolutely excellent. I struggle to think of anything I've seen better on either WCW or WWF television in a very long time.
I'd probably nominate Michaels and Jannetty from July of last year.
Yeah, that's probably the last thing that was this good. And again, you've got a logical pay-per-view build for it. So the people who have ordered Spring Stampede seen something inconclusive. Potentially you can convince them to come back and see a more legitimate finish, which, okay, this match maybe didn't have an entirely clean finish, but it was clean enough, and I wouldn't have felt ripped off if I'd have paid my money to watch this match on pay-per-view.
Yeah, as a reference in the news, the finish was, they're kind of like, they've gone off a good 30 minutes at this point. Steamboat kind of Irish Rich Flair into the ropes. Flair bounces off with the idea that Steamboat's going to leapfrog him. Now, this was by design, but Steamboat didn't quite get the leapfrog and Flair kind of collided with him. I think the idea was Flair meant to headbutt him in the nuts? Was that what they were going with?
I think that's what they were aiming for, but it just ended up in his stomach.
Yeah, and then, because then Steamboat went down, Flair went down, about 5 seconds went by, Flair went for the cover. And it's one of those things, like, you're in front of the kind of the Disney MGM crowd, which is kind of like cheer on demand, boo on demand. There are times when you're watching and it's like no proper crowd would cheer at that point during the thing. And so like that took away from it and they seemed a bit surprised that they went with it. And that's, again, it's, if it was in, I think I'm more agitated by doing a match of that magnitude in front of that crowd. Because it was a really odd audio track, I would say.
Yeah, it was certainly not the crowd that would have been most appreciative of it. At the very least, I would have seen this being saved for a Clash of the Champions in front of a proper audience. And okay, you're not getting pay-per-view money for it, but it's presented in a bigger context. But I guess if you're trying to draw more eyes to the television show, you could kind of point to this match and say, look, this is the kind of caliber of match you're going to see on television.
So before we move into our WWF TV review and our WWF discussion, you do a podcast, which is part of the reason we kind of brought you on the show, called the New Generation podcast. Talk us through all of that, where people can find it, and kind of the shows you've done so far.
We look at chronologically WWF pay-per-views. We started at King of the Ring 1993 and we're just kind of working our way through that. We have taken various detours to look at. We did an episode on the Steiner Brothers. We've looked at some WCW and we'll do that again at some point. There's myself, Adam Wykes and Paul Scrivens. We've been friends for a very, very long time. So it's nice for us to kind of sit down and talk about these shows, which is what we do anyway, but at some point we just decided let's record them and see what other people think of our random discussions. We often go very, very far off topic. And generally the response to the show has been very, very positive. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/New Generation Project Podcast. And you can find us on Twitter at the slightly simpler New Gen Podcast.
Yeah, you guys do kind of, it's pay-per-view reviews mainly, those you say you've done other stuff. You do a really good job and like a lot different to ours. I think your analysis of WrestleMania was about 2 hours long. I think our WrestleMania show was the same distance, but we had all the other stuff to cover as well. But I think for a much more in-depth look, because I try to keep our pay-per-view reviews to kind of 20, 25 minutes, but you guys, the WWF stuff, if you want more long form and a bit more random, shall we say, a bit more kind of deviation, tangents, definitely check it out, and we'll cover that more at the end of the show, but we'll move on to our WWF TV review. I'm going to walk through all of my notes and then I'll cover the bits we're going to discuss in turn. Diesel walked into the spot as the number one contender for Bret Hart's WWF title at King of the Ring. Basically, it was like the week after he won the Intercontinental title, he said, I'm coming for Bret Hart's WWF title, and then a week later, that match was set. We'll cover that and the machinations of that when we get there. Head Shrinkers defeated the Quebecers to win the tag title belts. Earthquake defeated Yokozuna in a sumo match. Jerry Lawler will face Roddy Piper at King of the Ring. The bill at the moment, not a lot's happened, but they're setting up for a big showdown between the two next week on King's Court. King of the Ring, the quarterfinals, it hasn't all played out on TV, but it's certainly all been taped yet. We've got IRS against Mabel, Razor Ramon against Bam Bam Bigelow, Jeff Jarrett versus the 1-2-3 Kid, and Tatanka versus Owen Hart. Nikolai Volkov is now under the toe of Ted DiBiase. They had a segment earlier this month, basically the story being that Volkov needs the money, so he was made to strip of all of his garb and wears trunks, bearing the message, property of the Million Dollar Man. And there are many more sightings of The Undertaker this month, just in various places, on the streets. We had a deli shop, I think it was last month. Ted DiBiase also said on commentary at one point that he was going to buy The Undertaker. I've no idea where this one is going. Stuart, we'll start really with Diesel. As I said, coming out of WrestleMania, I'm sure you guys did as well on your show. There are three guys coming out of WrestleMania with various claims of WWF title. You've got Yokozuna, the former champion, who Bret Hart said, I will give you a title match. You've got Lex Luger, who never won the title, and we've both done that, I assume, at length last year.
Yes.
And he's now tied up with Mr. Perfect, but Lex Luger was screwed out of his title match with Yokozuna. And we've got Owen Hart, the man who beat the incumbent champion in the open at WrestleMania. Three guys, all with various claims. Now, I'm not saying that any of these would have done bombastic numbers or any of these were like a jump out, standout choices. But to have those three and then to go and then Diesel just comes out and says, I want the WWF title. Strange.
It feels a little bit out of nowhere. I mean, I guess they've walked away from Yokozuna in that we've seen two Bret Yokozuna pay-per-view matches, so I guess that's why they're not going with that. He seems to be going off somewhere else away from the world title.
We've actually seen three. WrestleMania, King of the Ring. No, that was, sorry, no, that was, what am I about? That was Hogan, wasn't it? Yeah, number one, two. Both WrestleManias. Carry on.
Luger, I wonder where they're going with him. I mean, he's got to be considered a failed experiment now. Damaged goods. He's had the bus push into SummerSlam 1993. He's not managed to maintain that momentum. And it, in all honesty, as a babyface, he may be getting a reputation as the choke artist, you know? So do they scrap him entirely in that way and turn him heel? Do they send him off with someone as a manager, be it Cornette or DiBiase or someone, and try and rebuild him that way? Owen, yes, absolutely logical, and I fully expect them to face off at some point. But I guess he's kind of odds-on favourite for King of the Ring, which would again build to a later match between Brett. Diesel, I guess, fits Vince McMahon's idea of your world title contender. Yes, it feels very forced and very pushed, and he's had a very rapid sort of ascent post-Royal Rumble, but he's big, you know, he's got a presence, he's got a charisma, and he's got Shawn Michaels in his corner that can take away a lot of his shortcomings in the ring, and I feel that will be the match with he and Brett at King of the Ring.
Yeah, and also a lot of his shortcomings on promos. There's a very wooden Diesel promo at the end of this month as well on Raw. To pick up on one point you made, and this is kind of one of the things where, one of the reasons I'm kind of a bit kind of antsy about the whole thing. He hasn't had a rapid rise since the Royal Rumble. Since WrestleMania, I'll give you, they've kind of, you know, he won the Intercontinental title when he was featured heavily on episodes of TV after WrestleMania. Won the Intercontinental title and everything that's happened this month, etc., etc. But they gave him the massive monster push at the Royal Rumble, where he eliminated 7-8 guys in a row. He was a heel getting Diesel chants. And then they just forgot about him for about 8 weeks. He was like Royal Rumble never happened. He was just back in Shawn Michaels' corner. He was a bit part player at WrestleMania. And okay, it fit the story and it fit what they were doing with Shawn and Razor. But I think I would be more happy with it had he had just gone on a rampage since the Royal Rumble.
Yes, I mean, that would make more logical sense, but like you say, he had to take a back seat in that interim to the Shawn Razor plans. I mean, which obviously worked out in terms of match quality at WrestleMania. But yeah, I mean, this will be actually his first pay-per-view singles match, and he is the IC champion challenging for the world title. It's a hell of a big spot to be put into.
I guess one of the things we'll say and we'll come on to now is that this isn't the main event, or I don't believe it will be anyway. I think they're shaping up for the main event to be Jerry Lawler and Roddy Piper. I mean, this is, well, I believe that's where they're going with it. I mean, again, I guess you base it off the TV build at the moment, not, but I think they're going to feature that heavily next week. Although, I guess actually maybe the King of the Ring match might be last. That might make more sense.
I was about to say, so you've got three sort of matches with, I guess, legitimate claims to be the main event of the show. Which one of them gets shunted to the mid-card?
Well, last year it was Hogan and Yokozuna was in the mid-card, although given the really hokey finish they did with that, maybe that was part of the reason behind it. And I guess also from the mechanics of guys wrestling three times in one night, you kind of want to keep those spaced apart as far as possible. So I guess maybe more that I'm pretty confident the title match won't be the main event rather than Lawler will be, more than that. What do you think of Lawler and Piper? I mean, it's a bit of a strange one. And again, we haven't had much building. Piper cut a fairly basic promo from the back of his pickup truck, seemingly, on Raw. And they are going to face off next week. So I guess by the time we get around to King of the Ring, they'll have built that quite nicely. It's an odd pairing for Lawler, who's now back on TV a lot. But again, I don't get the sense he's going to be wrestling a ton. And Piper, who we saw at WrestleMania, but has been gone since. I think it's... I'm waiting to find out how they build this story before I can really tell you whether it's a good idea or not.
They really need a very strong segment going into King of the Ring for build for this. If they deliver that on a King's Court segment next week, then that's fine. If there is no big killer promo from either one of them, then yes, it will have had a very, very weak build. I guess this is an example of just going back to a star you know is marketable. Roddy Piper has obviously historically been quite a big draw for the WWF. You know, especially with Hogan going off to WCW. I mean, why didn't Vince say put Savage in this position against Lawler? that you would have had two people who are regularly on TV week by week, and you could have built it quite nicely.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it was just availability of Piper, but maybe you're right. Maybe this is them firing back at Hogan being on WCW. Okay, there's no WCW pay-per-view that month, though there is the Clash of the Champions. So maybe this is their ammunition of firing back. You've got Hogan, we've got Piper. Maybe that's it. What else have we got? Oh, this sumo match. This was different.
Yes, different is the word.
I mean, let's be honest, it was really bad, like awful. Like they built it up over a couple of weeks. It wasn't a throwaway by any stretch, and they built up Earthquake's history as a guy who, you know, has done sumo matches in the past. We get to the match, they're taking down the ring post, they decked out the ring in a new matting. We saw far too much of Earthquake's chest. There's a reason he wears a singlet. And then the match started, they butted chests, they pushed each other around a bit, and then after a couple of minutes, Yokozuna got pushed off, and that was that. I will give it a tick for novelty. I will give it a tick, as we said about scaffold matches about 6 or 7 months ago. The idea sounds far better than the execution, but this was really bad.
Yeah, like you say, if it is a one-off novelty and we never see it again, maybe retrospectively down the line, we will gain an appreciation for it. But as a segment in the here and now, it was quite excruciatingly bad.
Yeah, something like that. What else have we got? The tag title change, which we've covered. King of the Ring preview, the King of the Ring tournament itself. IRS against Mabel, Razor Ramon against Bam Bam Bigelow, Jeff Jarrett and the 1-2-3 Kid, and Tatanka and Owen Hart. Other than Owen Hart, maybe Razor, but this isn't a field that kind of fills me with, oh, I don't know what's going to happen here.
No, there's not a lot of clear winners. I mean, Owen is obviously the standout there and would make sense in a sort of logical build to Brett. If Diesel's winning the title at King of the Ring, could Razor be his first babyface opponent as champion?
Well, I was going to say logically it'd be a Brett in a rematch, but then again, logically Brett would face Yokozuna in a rematch, and he didn't go exactly there. Maybe. I mean, I'd be very surprised if Diesel wins the title. I mean, that's, at this stage in the game anyway, that's a real kind of...
Oh god, it would be a shocker. Yes, but...
Yeah.
Looking at kind of logical winners for this tournament, I'm trying to pick someone, say, from either side for, well, last year, obviously, Brett didn't necessarily go straight into the title picture, but that's where he's ended back up as King of the Ring.
Yeah.
As long as it's not Mabel, I'll be happy.
Well, or IRS.
Yeah.
Or Jeff Jarrett. 1-2-3 Kid. I mean, I guess if...
You could tell a good underdog story there.
Yeah, well, you could tell the same underdog story you told the year ago with him. I mean, they're kind of... He hasn't done a ton more recently. I mean, he was in that kind of 10-man tag at WrestleMania that got bumped. He's been on TV since, obviously, he won his kind of round of 16 qualification match. But yeah, I mean, I would guess Razor and Owen in the final. That's a marketable match. A strong babyface, a strong heel. Should be a really good match if they get the time as well. And that could be really good as well. I guess, it will be a lot more easy, assuming the title match goes on before the King of the Ring finals, as happened last year. I get the sense that, assuming Brett wins, Owen wins the other one, and then that's your logical thing going forward.
That would be the logical match for SummerSlam.
And that pretty much does it. There's not much else to talk about. We'll move into ECW TV discussion. A few notes before we get into the kind of the thing we're going to discuss. The Funk, Story Jr. and Terry Funk are going to reunite next month to face the Public Enemy in an ECW event. And as we said at the top in the news, Mikey Whipwreck, a jobber, defeated the Pitbull for the TV title after interference from the Tasmaniac. The one thing we're going to discuss this month is the Singapore Kane match. It's a mixed tag match. It was Tommy Cairo and Miss Peaches against Sandman and Woman. Now, I don't think we saw any part of this match, actually, because ECW don't show their live matches on TV, at least not straight away. But we did get a lot of build to this match. Sandman is now a chain-smoking heel. Not a very nice person to be around, long story short. And basically the story was, Tommy Cairo now seemingly is sleeping with Miss Peaches. He's certainly living in Sandman's house, which isn't the most babyface thing to do.
No.
And Sandman basically said, look, you're in my house, you're sleeping with my wife, you're eating my food, you're using my gym. You've probably racked up a bill of thousands of pounds, thousands of dollars rather, sorry, in America. But I will give it you for $100, as in basically you pay me $100 and you will save the beating you're going to get. Tommy Cairo, being the babyface, sleeping with his opponent's wife, said no, and they had the match. So the babyface is lost. And, yes, there was a Singapore caning after the match. And this seems to be, looks like it's going to continue afterwards. Again, we didn't see any of the match, so we can't really comment on that. But one thing I will say, the build for this was really good. I mean, also, this is way out there. This is, we know our audience, you know, you've got kind of all the rap music. They know the type of audience they're playing to. Really strong build, really edgy with stuff with, you know, sleeping with your opponent's wife as a baby face and all that. Sandman, I think, is doing some really nice work on his promos, smoking. He just doesn't seem like a very nice guy. And I guess that's the main part of this story, and everything else kind of falls into place, and the stipulation was very nice as well.
I mean, we've obviously seen the sort of family-based storylines in the WWF with Bret Hart versus Owen Hart, but like you say, this is something on a whole other level. And, you know, watching it, I was kind of confused as to whether Tommy Cairo is a babyface. I don't watch Eastern Championship Wrestling a whole lot. So, you know, yes, he's in this chap's house sleeping with his wife. What part of that makes him the babyface in the feud? But like you say, Sandman is presented as, you know, such an obnoxious character. He's definitely not the babyface. So you've got a lot of sort of blurred lines going on in there, which I gather the Philadelphia audience really likes.
Yeah, and equally, I really get the sense this is more a feud for Sandman rather than a feud that's trying to be an even Steven feud. I think this is more, we've changed direction with Sandman. He's not a surfer anymore. He's not wearing a wetsuit when he's in the ring, etc., etc. He comes out, he lights a fag when he's in the ring and all that stuff. Those listening in America, that's a cigarette. I know that word does not cross the Atlantic very well.
Connotation.
He lights a cigarette when he's in the ring and all that stuff. And yeah, it's really different. I must say, as a general rule, ECW TV this month, the match quality is what it is. You know, most of the stuff they hide from us because obviously they're a regional promotion and their main aim is to get people to buy tickets. So it is in their interest to show big matches at the time. We got the big 60-minute time limit draw, we got a tape of at the time. They haven't shown that other than brief clips on the show. But promo-wise and a lot of the storyline stuff is so good at the moment. And we had one, we had Paulie Dangerously going into the hood to recruit Public Enemy, which is a great segment. Just to see Paulie Dangerously in, I think it's like a baseball jersey, I think. He's got sunglasses on, he's got a baseball cap on the wrong way round, and he's trying to recruit the Public Enemy with 911 as his enforcer, just to back up Sabu and Funk, things blur, lines blur, where all these guys on roster are concerned. Shane Douglas is cutting really good promos. Terry Funk is cutting really good promos. The Public Enemy are cutting really good promos. Even Jason had a very nice promo after the Tasmaniac basically bit his face off, although Jason did basically call him a monkey, which I'm a bit uneasy about.
There are
lines where it's like, this is edgy, and, you know, like the Tasmaniac, I guess, I don't think it's racist, but I think that's what it's coming across as, and I wouldn't have gone that far. I don't think it's meant to be racist anyway. But that's kind of what it's coming across as, but yeah, that Tasmaniac's doing okay and all that, and instead of it, as I say, it is a bit of a shame since we're not getting the payoffs on TV, but then again, it is a regional promotion, so I don't think we can complain. And that will do that for this month. Stuart, as we do at the end of each month's show, we recommend one thing that people, if they're only going to watch one thing, go back and watch. What is your match or moment of the month?
Oh, easily the Cactus Jack Kevin Sullivan Nasty Boys match. Go out of your way to see that.
Yeah, I got a feeling I ended up giving last month's to The Boss and Vader, and just because Vader's great, and he was great this month as well, actually. I don't think we played up how good he was in his match against Sting. But, yeah, I mean, like, go back and watch, like, this month's match with the Nasty Boys, the month from April with the Nasty Boys. The one from February was less of a walking brawl, but it, as I think I said at the time, it was kind of a very watchable car crash, I would call their match from February. But
I think that's what they all are.
Oh, completely. But this one, as I said, great, and in amongst some questionable kind of booking decisions, but I guess more, you know, as I said, kind of at the end of the part, that, you know, you've got to give them some allowance given the amount of changes that went on. This was the baby faces get it, the heels getting the comeuppance, and the baby faces finally getting over, even though it ended up basically kind of 5-on-2. This was the payoff to the story. Like, Nasty Boys doing some great work, and this was probably the pinnacle of the match. And I'd watched combinations of this match again. I don't know whether they're going to do it in a couple of months when we get to the next pay-per-view, but we will see. Anyway, that will wrap up this month's show. Stuart, we're out of 20 years ago mode now, so we can cover your project podcast in a bit more detail. But yeah, so kind of promote it again very quickly and kind of tell us where you're at now, because you're in, what, Rumble 95 now, I think, is where you're at?
Yeah. So basically what we're doing is King of the Ring 93 all the way up until WrestleMania 14. Obviously our inspirations were very much kind of OSW Review and the Attitude Era podcast. Actually, one of the things that kind of inspired it is that Adam and I had actually sat down and chronologically watched all these Attitude Era pay-per-views and had all these conversations. And then we found out that, you know, it was a viable option, that other people were kind of recording them and broadcasting them, and they were being received quite well. So there was a logical gap there as well, in that sort of new generation era period. And it's quite an interesting period to cover as well. It's not, by any definition, a golden era, is it? It falls between those two really kind of revered, you know, people either grew up a Hulkamaniac or they got into wrestling when they were at university or college or whatever. But, I mean, the first stuff I watched was 92, 93, that's when I first got Sky as a child. So it's quite interesting for me to go back and rewatch all these shows and stuff. And Adam remembers bits and bobs of it, and Paul didn't start watching wrestling until Royal Rumble 2000. So, you've got kind of three very different viewpoints on it as well. And yeah, it seems to be something we're enjoying continuing to do, and the response seems to keep getting better and better.
Yeah, I mean, I may not have said this on the show before, but this is an era of wrestling, 93 through kind of just before Nitro starts, where this is the kind of thing where documentaries come around. They mention Raw starting in the Manhattan Center. They may or may not mention the steroid trial, depending on what the documentary is. They'll mention Hogan signing with WCW, and then Nitro starts. And that's all in the space of about 3 or 4 minutes. It's covering basically kind of when you started King of the Ring, when we started at SummerSlam last year, and right through for the next kind of year or so. Like, Lex Luger never gets a mention. Yokozuna never gets a mention. All right, Hart and Michaels do. Those are the rising stars. Diesel, they gloss over because it ends up being such a kind of gigantic failure and all that. And so, you know, but there's so much stuff that you just never bear witness to. And I think it's great that, you know, I mean, all right, I think we both started projects kind of because you're just to clarify, you started, was it November last year?
November last year.
So you're kind of just rifling through shows. I'm doing it in the much more difficult way of doing it month by month, much slower. Yeah. But, you know, we started pre-network, but we've kind of almost got the jump on, well, now all this stuff's really easy to find and people can go and watch it really easily. And also, you know, like for you, you're doing pay-per-view reviews, which is easier. For me, I'm doing a lot of TV stuff. Some of it's there, some of it's not. The Clash of Champions has just gone up, which is great because we've got one of those next month. And it's great that we kind of, we're able as podcasters and people who are just subscribing to the network, able to unlock all this old content and find out that Raw wasn't always in the Manhattan Center. One of the things that I love about all these documentaries, but people think Raw was in the Manhattan Center for about 4 years.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden it was just in 20,000 seat arenas.
Raw was in the Manhattan Center for about 5 months, and then they came back maybe once or twice. But don't get me wrong, they weren't like doing arenas or anything like that. They're in like high school gyms and like very small and random places across New York and the Northeast. But it's just, that's the kind of best illustration I can say why the documentaries and stuff are so inferior, is that people have perceptions about all this. And they will mention WCW being in MGM and all that right before we get to Nitro and whatnot. But there's a lot of stuff to come, and not all of it good. I know you guys have just done the Rumble 95 and whatnot. But no, it is an intriguing time. It's very noteworthy. And the great thing is that, like, WCW pay-per-view last month, I would stack up against any pay-per-view I've ever seen. I'm not saying it's the best, but I would put it in the mix. And nobody ever talks about that show.
I mean, yeah, there's a bunch of stuff and a bunch of performers that I think get overlooked. And again, I think Paul's viewpoint is perhaps one of the most unique, certainly amongst the three of us when we do it, is that, you know, there's a lot of people there that he's never seen, he's never heard of. And as anybody who listens to us will know, Jimmy Del Rey has been sort of this amazing standout performer that he's seen and really grown to love. And
yeah,
all three of us, Bull Nakano's another one who is just, okay, she's only there for a very short period of time, but wow, what an impact she makes in the few appearances she gets. So there's a lot of performers, a lot of characters, and like you say, a lot of shows that don't often come up or get glossed over in terms of nostalgia, that it is actually fun to go back and look at and say, well, actually, you know, this person did some really interesting stuff that I wasn't expecting for the time. But yes, at the same time, we're about 2 months off doing King of the Ring 1995, and I'm really quite dreading it.
Yeah. What's WrestleMania 11? What we've got?
WrestleMania 11 is dreadful as well, yeah. So, I mean, the Rumble 95, actually, I quite enjoyed. And I think we all did. But, yeah, I mean, WrestleMania 11 is the LT Bam Bam main event. And
oh, yeah, you know, that's right.
The show's really centred around the celebrities rather than the actual wrestlers in it. And it kind of hurts the overall feel of the show. I'm hoping Adam and Paul aren't listening to this at the minute, because you're
going to review it in about 3 weeks.
Well, yeah, we're watching it, recording next Sunday, actually.
Right.
What I've asked them to do is book the WrestleMania card based on what we've watched over the past few months and where they would logically go for it. Because I'm expecting neither of them to kind of, you know, come up with, well, I'll put a football player in my main event against a mid-card heel. So the reaction to that should be quite interesting.
Yeah, we will wrap up the show now. So Stuart, again, just kind of wrap up your Twitter, your Facebook, and your podcast is iTunes and RSS and places like that. Just promote that again and we can get that done.
Yep, Facebook is facebook.com/NewGenerationProjectPodcast. Twitter is @NewGenPodcast. Yep, you can find us on iTunes. If anyone wants to leave us a nice review on iTunes, I keep plugging this everywhere I can. Feel free, we do appreciate it. SoundCloud, soundcloud.com/NewGenPodcast is a way if you don't like iTunes or don't have it. And yeah, we're on stuff like Stitcher Radio, Pile Driver Wrestling and Botchamania as well.
Excellent. You can find our show at wrestling20years.com, on Twitter at wrestling20yrs. We're not on Facebook because I can't be bothered. And we're on iTunes. If you want to leave us a rating and a review, yeah, that's always very much appreciated. RSS feed is on the site as well if you want to pick that up and put it in whatever kind of podcast feed you've got there as well. And that's it for this month. We're back next month. We've got King of the Ring 94, Clash of the Champions. And then July, we've got the steroid trial, which I'm going to have to start revising. That's going to be a lot of fun. Anyway, Stuart, big thanks for joining me today, and I'm sure we'll kind of get you on the show again soon. And until next time, goodbye.